Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Bernadette Sargent, and I represent the appellant David W. Noble. Your Honors, the appellant requests in this case that the lower court's decision in favor of the individual appellee officers of the National Association of Letter Carriers and the union, the National Association of Letter Carriers, be reversed and remanded so that the district court can apply the appropriate legal standard in deciding whether the union officials violated their fiduciary obligations under the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, Section 501A. Appellant also requests that the district court finding that his claim under Section 201C of the same act, the LMRDA, is moot, be reversed as clearly erroneous and contradicted by the record. With regard to the Section 501A claim, the district court, we would submit, abused its discretion by failing to apply the appropriate level of scrutiny to examine whether appellee union officers breached their fiduciary duties.
Well, appropriate level of scrutiny, we've consistently said that the Constitution doesn't give courts a license to intrude too far into a union's affairs.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Well, what we're asking is that this court adopt...
Well, I think we've said considerable deference.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. What we're asking is that this court apply the standard that was applied by the Second Circuit in Morrissey v. Curran, which, as we discussed in our briefs, in 2003, when the district court judge denied the parties' respective motions for summary judgment, he wrote an opinion which is published as Noble v. Sombrato, essentially adopting the Morrissey v. Curran standard and saying that even if there is authorization, the court does grant deference, but in a situation where union funds are used to personally enrich union officers, the courts will examine, even in the...
Well, it also benefits the union here, though, right? Doesn't it benefit the union in terms of, we could go through each category, but in terms of administrative convenience, also giving some of its officers the ability to use the funds for union purposes?
I have a twofold response to that, or we have a twofold response to that. One is that that's not determinative. Even if theoretically there is a benefit to the union by these various allowances, double payments of per diems, reimbursement for Social Security and Medicare taxes, even if there's a theoretical union, that's not a benefit to the union, that's not determinative. There should still be an examination of whether, under the Morrissey standard, it's manifestly unreasonable for these funds to have been paid to personal enrichment of the officers.
I thought your central contention as to unreasonableness was not the quantities involved, but the misrepresentations with respect to them.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That is one of our most important contentions. It's the failure to disclose an affirmative misleading of the membership by the union officers over a period of decades. But I think it's illustrative to look at whether the court even bothered to look at amounts or method of payment as a way to look at whether it recognized and exercised its discretion under Morrissey.
I'm not quite sure about the district court's discretion. It seems to me the issues of law, which are clearly for us, issues of fact, which are reviewable on a clearly erroneous standard.
Your Honor, that's correct. Frankly, in our brief, in stating the standard for review, we did note that obviously the application of the correct law is reviewable de novo by this court. I do think, and it might be making it harder for ourselves than it needs to be, that if we say that the district court did recognize Morrissey in 2003, and there was no disavowal of Morrissey at any point between 2003 and 2006, that it did appreciate the appropriate standard. Once that's in place, the question can become, as I said, it might be making it more difficult for us than it needs to be, whether under that standard the court undertook the appropriate steps and recognized its own authority and duties to examine material facts to rule in accordance with that standard, and essentially whether it apply the appropriate level of judicial scrutiny under.
Your position is that payments can be authorized by the union constitution, but still be manifestly unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that's what Morrissey says.
I understand. And does that make sense?
Yes. Yes,
why,
it does.
Why is that? If the union constitution sets forth various parameters and they follow that, why does it make sense for a court to impose something more on top of that?
Well, there's a quite good discussion, I think, in Morrissey about the fact that Section 501, first of all, was enacted because of concerns about internal union corruption. And it explicitly states that the union officers have a fiduciary duty to its members. In order to really enforce that, an examination of all of a fiduciary duty in its appropriate breadth under 501, it shouldn't be that just because you are arguably acting in compliance with the Constitution and bylaws of the union, that you have necessarily fulfilled your fiduciary duty. Morrissey does make the point, which obviously we think is correct, that in the Section 501 itself, there is a provision specifically prohibiting generally exculpating resolutions by the union body absolving officials from arguable breaches of fiduciary duty. So that's why we would submit that Morrissey is the appropriate standard for this court to apply. It's the standard that makes the most sense and takes the most account of the concerns of Section 501.
Is there a particular amount of a per diem that makes it manifestly unreasonable?
I would say no. I would say that it
just
depends.
Just any per diem?
Any per diem that would provide unquestioning double compensation without question, which is what.
Why is it double compensation? We're talking about the convention per diem?
Yeah, the convention per diem. Mm-hmm. The record does.
I thought they were off expenses for that week.
Off expenses in terms of the monthly allowance or,
mm-hmm.
Well, the per diem, the problem with the per diem was that officers who were not in a position to actually be losing salaried time were having lost time compensation awarded to them in the per diem. And in instances where the officers may or may not have received subsidized lodging or free lodging, they were being paid for per diem. It's sort of comparable to cases about 10 years ago that came to people's attention where government officials might have gone to a particular travel location and they took a hotel per diem even though they stayed with friends or they stayed with locals for less money. They still claimed the full hotel per diem, and that was inappropriate. And that's very comparable to what was going on with union official per diem compensation in this situation. So it wouldn't necessarily matter the raw numbers.
Wasn't all of this ultimately brought to the attention of the union in convention assembled and, one might say, ratified by the union?
Well, I think we would take issue with, we wouldn't concede that it was necessarily ratified by the union. What happened was appellant Noble brought internal charges, mm-hmm. which were rejected by the members in a special convention in 1993. Mm-hmm. However, we would submit that rejecting charges, even forgetting all the behind the scenes, whether it was an appropriately conducted convention, rejecting charges is not the same as ratifying the action. And similarly, in the 1994 and 1996 conventions, actions either rejecting or accepting resolutions doesn't really, we would submit, go to a ratification or adoption of the original actions, payments and expenditures.
I can't recall, are you making a claim of deceit with respect to the per diems?
Yes, Your Honor, we are. And that.
And the deceit is based on what?
That at the conventions themselves, at the outset, a member of the per diem and mileage committee, I believe it's called, went before the convention and explained that per diems would be awarded based on several factors, including lost time and lodging costs and other costs.
Right.
At the end of the convention, there would be a general statement about the amount of per diems that were awarded. And we would submit that that created the impression among the membership that everybody who was receiving the per diem compensation incurred lost time and lodging expenses.
That's based entirely on the time gap between the two propositions?
Not just the time gap, but the inference that is created and not rebutted. That is our argument with regard to misleading of the membership with regard to whether...
Do we have anything in the record about whether, say, an ordinary member going to the National Convention and getting a per diem could take it even if he stayed with his cousin?
I don't think we have anything in the record on that explicit provision. But we do have it in the record that officers didn't always pay for their rooms but received compensation.
Say that sentence again.
I do not believe we have it explicitly in the record that the ordinary rank and file member might get a hotel per diem. First of all, I don't know.
So the record doesn't address that one way or the other?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Although it's perfectly plausible that many of the people, perhaps, at the convention were getting per diems and staying with relatives, staying in a much cheaper hotel, eating grubby food.
Yeah, I suppose, Your Honor, that is possible, and I'm not aware during my... As I have time during my opponent's argument, I'll look for it.
This is almost a yes or no question. I hope it is. Are the 201C questions and the 501C questions totally always interconnected, or are there any independent claims in either statute?
In this particular, they are separate.
501A, I mean, or the 501. They are separate?
Yes, they are separate, Your Honor. And I see the yellow light is on, so I'd like to say something. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Simon, Cone, Licensed Simon from the National Association of Letter Carriers. At council table, my partner Peter Herman, and Nick Femia of O'Donohue and O'Donohue, counsel for the individual union defendants. Your Honor, this case was filed in 1994 and deals with union resolutions by the Executive Council in 1980 during the presidency of Jimmy Carter. The case
well,
has
not
a certain...
all it deals with. I mean, at least certain, one thing of interest is the 1986 convention, which was not that long. I mean, it's now 21 years ago, but it's not that long after the initiation of the suit.
Right. That is correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I would like to address first, unless Your Honor has a specific question about 1986, and I will turn to it, address the standard of review, because notwithstanding appellant's assertion that somehow this is an abuse of discretion case, and notwithstanding that actually representing appellees, we might be better with the higher bar that an abuse of discretion would provide, it's simply not the law. The case is before you on a classic review, clearly erroneous for the facts, de novo for the law, and the abuse of discretion cases cited by appellant in the main and reply briefs all deal with idiosyncratic cases where the discretion was actually at the heart of what the district court was supposed to do, specifically in the Shiriro Supreme Court recent case cited by appellant. It was a habeas corpus murder case. The question was the refusal of the district court to grant an evidentiary hearing. That was a matter specifically relegated to the district court's discretion. And the matter was reviewed, obviously, as to whether or not that discretion had been abused. Similarly, in the District of Columbia, the Herbin case was a question of a new trial for murder there, too. That was a matter specifically directed to the district court's discretion, and therefore the review was one of discretion. This is a classic case, a bench trial, findings of fact, application of the law, and it calls for the clear, straightforward, clearly erroneous de novo approaches that this court would take. On the facts, Judge Sullivan made 42 detailed findings of fact.
Could we talk about finding of fact 11? It starts out saying no evidence has been presented that the in-town expense allowance was utilized by resident officers for purely personal reasons unrelated to union business. Now, it is, I think, undisputed that the officers collected the $500 on the basis of a simple assertion, an application for it. It's also, I think, undisputed that the a tiny fraction of the total sums paid out was matched with any sort of receipted bills. And I think it's undisputed that most of these officers were, it seems hard to believe that they were not in income brackets where they would have been subjected to income tax, according to the undisputed record, on portions that were not matched by receipts. So that's no evidence?
All of the above of your reflections are clearly reflected in the record, but there is also in the record a statement by then-President Sombrato on the stand that as far as he knew, those monies were being expended for matters related to union benefit, and there was no evidence to the contrary. It is true.
Well, let's just go back. You are saying, in effect, that there is some evidence in the record to support a conclusion that the money was spent for union purposes. But this statement here that I'm quoting does not say that. It says no evidence has been presented to the contrary.
And let me address that specifically.
Unless I'm mistaken about my review of what was presented, that is flatly wrong.
With all due respect, I think it is quite correct, and the statements that Your Honor made following it are also quite correct. The fact is that some union officers, like humanity in general, keep shoeboxes of receipts. Others do not. There was no evidence that any of the money received by any of the officers was expended for purely personal reasons, another finding of Judge Robinson. There was evidence that they received that money, whether or not they actually submitted receipts for it.
We're sort of into the weight of the evidence now, but I guess before we get to the weight of the evidence, we're entitled to look at what the district judge said. And what the district judge says is no evidence has been presented that they were used. Now, it would seem to me that the enormous discrepancy between the receipts and the payments and the, I would have thought, considerable incentive that officers had to take the receipts out of the shoebox and dump them before whoever hands out the money would be evidence. maybe not conclusive evidence, but certainly evidence.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, had there been evidence that any of the money received by any of the individual defendants had, in fact, been spent for other than union business, I would understand Your Honor's point.
I don't think you're hearing what I've said. Process of inference from what appear to be undisputed facts, right? You have the applications for the $500. You have a tiny fraction of that matched by receipts. You have a strong pecuniary incentive on the part of the people making the application because of the tax consequences to submit receipts to the extent that they covered eligible expenses. And they don't submit them, except for a minimal fraction. So that is evidence. if you say it's not a slam dunk, I would agree. It's not a slam dunk, but it's evidence.
I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the possibility one might draw the inference Your Honor says could be drawn is not the same as saying as to whether or not there's evidence. I believe Judge Sullivan...
Are you drawing a distinction between circumstantial and direct evidence?
And I would...
You're saying the plaintiff here could only win if... I'm really not sure how it could be done. He'd have to pursue an officer around town 24/7 for a month and establish, on what I hear you to be saying, that that less than $500 of the officer's expenditures in that month were for union matters.
Your Honor, there was extensive discovery in this case. Discovery went on, I believe, for 10 years.
How exactly would discovery cover this?
Well, one could inquire and develop evidence as to whether or not individuals were submitting and collecting out-of-town expenses for non-union benefit-related functions. Judge Sullivan, I believe, also concluded, as I would expect the court should respect that conclusion, that $500 a month in-town expenses, a number which hasn't been changed since the 1970s, in the Washington, D.C. area in the pursuit of union business is not an unreasonable amount of money. And
I don't know what's reasonable.
Well, I guess you could draw the inference from...
here about reasonableness, but it seems to me, at least with respect to the $500 a month, the gravamen of the complaint is that the statements made by and in the presence of union officers conveying to the membership the notion that all this money was matched by particular expenses, that's the core of it, and I would think evidence has been presented in support of the plaintiff on that matter.
I understand Your Honor's position. I would hope that upon reflection of the record as a whole, which does not disclose, for instance, that each of the individual union defendants submitted minuscule amounts of receipts in support of their expense allowance. It was highly idiosyncratic.
To some extent, we do have names.
I'm sorry?
I believe to some extent we do have names.
Yes, you do. You have names and you have amounts, but it is by no means all of the individual union defendants. Some, in fact, did submit details.
For the person that was not receipted, they had declared that as income?
They did, and they paid income tax on it, and that is in the record. In fact, one of the comments, I believe it was the 1986 convention comment, addressed that specifically. Comment from the floor was that they received $500 in unaccountable expenses, and one of the national officers said, trust me, it's accountable, you can check with the IRS. And there is...
Okay. I mean, that's, of course, silly, because there's very strong protection of tax returns in the possession of the IRS.
But I don't believe there's any evidence to contradict the evidence in the record that matters that were not covered by expense chits were, in fact, reported to the IRS as income and taxes were paid on. Your Honor, I think
that,
this...
That, of course, is a little different, because the... what all that means is that the overage, which is about 90%, was taxable income. It doesn't show at all that it was for union expenses.
In fact, it suggests that the individual who did not keep the shoebox was prepared to pay the tax on that money.
Right. Yeah, but he could do that without regard to whether it was in fact legitimate union business. He could have incurred no expense that was a legitimate union business and still paid taxes on the money.
That is correct, Your Honor.
It might be more likely.
That is correct, Your Honor. But one of the bedrock principles of the judicial review of union expenditures and internal union affairs is that the federal court does not have license to interfere broadly.
There are cases, including ones from this circuit, relating to disclosure. And
there are indeed.
Some of them talk simply about a requirement of reasonable disclosure. And here, the contention is that there's not merely non-disclosure, there's affirmative deceit.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I may address disclosure, unless Your Honor wishes to...
No, go ahead.
Please do.
You can really distinguish between the manner in which the courts view unions' external affairs, strikes, boycotts, extortion, which has a very detailed legislative and judicial oversight.
Let it alone. It has nothing to do with this. Go to
that. That is correct. Well, but the obverse is that when it comes to internal affairs, the court should apply a very light hand in terms of intrusion in internal affairs.
Do you have any case saying that deceit by the securing approval of funds from a union convention by means of deceit is perfectly okay under the statute?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but nor is that this case. There was no deceit here. This union has complied fully with the detailed requirements of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, a highly specific requirement that the union complies with. This court is aware that the Department of Labor has forms that must be filled out. There's a battle in this court that's been here, I think, at least twice to the district court, perhaps once here, over Department of Labor's efforts to require more detailed reporting. What the union reports now would comply even with that contested, more strenuous report. So that in terms of reporting and disclosure, the union complied with its internal constitutional requirements and complied with the specific statutory requirements regarding reporting and disclosure. So the question comes down purely then to the Section 501 question. And there, this court has not adopted Morrissey v. Curran. And the suggestion by appellant that this court cited it approvingly in Manzillo is simply inaccurate.
We have Cephalo.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
We have our decision in Cephalo, which which reports that the same panel evidently had issued an order effectively requiring or delaying an action until there had been disclosure.
Is that the Manzillo case, Your Honor,
no,
the
Cephalo.
Union convention?
Cephalo.
Cephalo.
For these reasons, we provided in our order that the district court may require such procedures as it deems necessary to ensure a free and informed vote.
Your Honor, even in Manzillo, the question was...
honesty would be necessary.
That's like what the court did in Manzillo, which was to, in effect, stay the union's executive council, which had departed from its previous policy of reporting and was taking action to spend millions of dollars of the union's funds to buy a new headquarters a month before the convention, to delay it until the convention. The convention occurred. The Court of Appeals, this court noted that the convention, having endorsed the executive council's interpretation of its own constitution and bylaw, in effect mooted out the case. And we would argue, Your Honor, that even, and I see the light is on, but even if Morrissey were to be applied, there is no set of circumstances under which these expenditures in this world could be considered manifestly unreasonable. I'm not going to dwell on
that sentence, and that your light is on, so unless my colleagues have further questions, then your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. How much time do you have?
I'm sorry, 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, Your Honor.
All right.
Just to respond to a couple of points. With regard to the LMRDA's formal reporting requirements, we would submit that that is distinct from, formal reporting requirements should be distinct from candor to the union membership. Just because you comply with the formal requirements of the Act doesn't mean that you can still hide things from the membership. That's the first thing. The second thing is that there was an internal requirement in the Constitution that the President report his official actions to the membership at the convention. And certainly to vote as part of the Executive Council to allow yourself a $500 a month allowance is an official action that should have
been. Yeah, but everyone knew there was a $500 a month allowance.
Well, Your Honor, I don't.
The question is what were the terms under which it was given?
I don't think it's established that everybody knew. I mean, in fact, in 1976 and then in 1986, when individual delegates stood up and said, I have a question about this, in 76, the then president denied that it existed. And in 86, the response that was made was, it's accountable if you don't believe, but that was to throw her off the scent,
right,
that there was a $500 allowance. And if the...
I will be using up some of the little time you have left, but I started on this at the end of your first address and didn't follow it. Why isn't the 201C part of your case moot?
Because the court specifically based its finding on a finding that appellant Noble no longer claims he hasn't gotten all the documents he's needed.
But what is it he's seeking that he doesn't have? What could be done for 201C relief on remand?
201C would require that the union provide him with documents to verify the accuracy of their annual.
What documents? I understand the general terms of 201C, but I'm not sure what's left in this case that hasn't been disclosed, discovered, and spread upon the record by this time.
There were documents that were described in Mr. Noble wrote, I believe it was a November 1993 letter to the president of the union requesting additional documents. That request was denied. The letters are in the appendix.
What's left now that he hasn't gotten through either the union's disclosure process internally or discovery in the court?
I do believe that there are financial backup documents still outstanding, Your Honor. The appellees
can you identify from the record before us what that would be?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Unless, if you give me a second to look at the file here.
Maybe you can make a supplemental finding if you have a supplemental filing if you have something on that. If there is a supplemental filing, you'll be given a chance to respond, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you both. The case is submitted. Call the next case.